45 megavolts. Even though the very first step might be a millimeter, the very next step is going to be a very big step, because the voltage, the E field you've got is building up some very high velocity of those free electrons that you freed up in that first millimeter. And therefore, they have the ability to jump the whole 120 feet, and after that, they're going to keep doing that because of the voltage that's available. It's just the way it works. That's a theory that I've just given you. We've probably gone far enough on this right now, Roy. And maybe you...
I'm sorry.
Maybe you want to go over to your next subject, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, but I have just one more thing. I don't see just the reason.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
About it.
Wesley, you timed out the machine. I just also want to add, for anyone interested, that apparently there are about 50 to 100 lightning strikes on this planet every second of every hour of every day. So there's a lot of lightning to go. And if you like 80 meters and 160 meters, you can hear most of it there.
I was only asking, how come you see neutron evolving to proton? This is unheard of. And to achieve.
I don't understand why it's unheard of. Neutrons are not stable as free neutrons. Give enough time, a neutron has a half-life of about 15 minutes, I think. It decays into a proton, electron, and an anti-electron neutrino. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Protons are very stable. Neutrons are not.
So provide me with the material. I would be very much happy to read that. In a traditional way that I understand it, you have a nucleus and you cannot evolve. In between nucleus, you cannot evolve proton, neutron to proton.
These are neutrons that have been smacked with a relativistic electron and not free. Free neutrons, as I said, unfortunately, are not stable. They do decay. And I will email you the Wikipedia of neutron decay. That will say that exact thing.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Next step, thank you for education. Guys, you never mentioned very interesting stuff. How come you hear the sound on lightning, Dr. Roy?
WS2N.
Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, Roy, you clipped out when you said how many lightning strikes per second. You went at real quick, said it. So we missed the number.
Okay, it was 50 to 100 strikes per second all the time.
That's a lot if you had that up all day. All day, all night.
Very good.
Thanks. I did not hear that. Sometimes you clip out. Well, I'm not sure why, but you know, it's almost like a quick release of the push to talk button or something. So that happens once in a while. Thank you, Roy.
Maybe I overmodulate a little bit. I have to talk more softly. Wes, when lightning heats up, gives off black body radiation, a high temperature, producing shock waves, that's what thunder is.
Yeah, that is very much explosive. It takes only 1 second, and 30,000 degrees is amazing.
Yes, Mother Nature can be amazing. Dick, you want to respond to the dark matter, right?
Yes, go right ahead, Roy. I'll just give a couple of quick words, and that is there's a recent article in Scientifica. Let's say, no, it's a Smithsonian. Smithsonian has an article about the fact that they've discovered a galaxy. By measuring the rotational velocity and the velocity profile, of various galaxies, and knowing how many stars are there by the amount of illumination you're seeing, you find out that the amount of rotation tells you that there's an amount of local gravity a hell of a lot higher than the visual stars you're seeing, and that phenomena has up till now been called dark matter. They know that there's something creating a lot of gravity, a lot of matter, a lot of mass somewhere in that galaxy. Well, they found a galaxy where the rotation rate was just right and there was no dark matter. So they used to think that every galaxy has a certain percentage of dark matter, and they're starting to find galaxies without dark matter. That's what I got out of that Smithsonian article. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Hey, C2GX. I mean, I got the same thing. Basically, galaxies have a bunch of shapes. What we're familiar with is the Milky Way is an elliptical, is a spiral. They also come elliptical, and the cross between elliptical and spiral is called lenticular. And then there's one very strange shape, which is called kind of ultra-disc galaxies or fluffy galaxies. And one of them they found with this charming NGC 1052-DF2 was very curious, because by looking at it, you can tell the spin of these objects and then try and figure out what their mass is. And you can see the amount of light and figure out how many black holes. And usually it comes up with a strange number, because most of the stuff that's producing the mass is thought to be dark matter. And that's usually some ridiculous quantity, like 80% of a black hole of a galaxy or something. They found out that this particular galaxy was spinning very, very, very slowly, barely at all. And so they plugged in the numbers, and behold, it has a negligible amount of dark matter to it, which is a curiosity, because people sort of thought that every galaxy has a percentage, if not the same, but roughly the same. But this is practically no dark matter. Let me drop. Now, some people might say, well, great, because that's kind of proof that dark matter is probably doesn't exist, because you got this galaxy, and it's a perfectly fine galaxy, and it doesn't have anything that we call dark matter, so let's have a party and forget about it. And other people at the other end of the spectrum say, no, but this is absolutely proof that there's dark matter, because if you were misreading galaxies, and every galaxy had the same dark matter percentage, then maybe you were having a complete breakdown in your theories and just adding it up all wrong. But this particular galaxy not having any means that there's something that's not inherent that we're calling dark matter. So those guys are having their party on their side. So that's kind of what's going on with this discovery. But just to keep in mind, there are galaxies that are flipped the other way. There are galaxies that are 99.9% dark matter and have almost nothing in them. There's an entity called Dragonfly 44 from the Dragonfly Observatory that found one that's something like 300 million light years away. And supposedly, theoretically, there is a galaxy called Galaxy X, which is very local to us. Let me drop. About 30 million light years away, which is close, surprisingly. I think it's 30. And there are three Cepheid stars. And if you remember when I was explaining how to figure out how heavy things are and such, Cepheid stars are variable stars that blink. And by knowing the intensity and the rate of the blink, you can figure out the luminosity. And by the luminosity, you could figure out how far they are and all kinds of interesting things. And there's four of these things just sitting out beyond the Milky Way galaxy just by themselves. And the theory is that they're clumped up in a massive dark star galaxy called, charmingly, Galaxy X. It has no relationship to Planet X, but name. So there are galaxies, apparently, that are all dark matter. There are galaxies now that are almost no dark matter. So take your pick. What is dark matter? Damned if I know.
When it comes to the candidates for dark matter, are some of the candidates a good mixture of neutron stars and black holes buried within that galaxy? Is that a possible explanation? Or even with the best guess as to the number of neutron stars and the number of black holes, that in some cases even that can't come close? What do you think, Roy?
Well, my understanding is that neutron stars aren't that black. Black holes are that black, but then you have to deal with accretion disks and all. There are theories that the primordial black holes, which I mentioned last week, black holes that were created at the dawn of the universe, that are outside of the general accretion disks of matter, might be what dark matter is. Other people thought for about an hour and a half that all the neutrinos, if they had just enough mass, they might be dark matter, but it doesn't look like that. And others believe in things called WIMPs, weakly interactive massive particles, which have a lot to do with something called supersymmetry, which they're trying feverishly at the accelerator to manufacture and not getting anywhere with supersymmetric particles. There's a few more out there that people are thinking about, but there's no good proof for any of it. They're building detectors without quite knowing what they plan to detect. It's unfortunate. Dark matter, dark energy, there are some people who hate the concept of it being called dark matter either. They say it's transparent matter. It's not necessarily black, so it's not dark. But, you know, again, that's semantics. But again, if anyone is interested in a Nobel Prize, feel free to figure out what the heck either dark matter or dark energy is, and I'm willing to bet you they'll give you one. They may even give you two. Well, that's my spiel on dark matter. Anyone have any comments about dark matter, any interest in dark matter, or even dark energy? What do you think, Dick? Should I move on to the next topic?
We have some time, and therefore I recommend you do, Roy. Go right ahead. And you're allowed to choose any subject from DC to light.
Okay, I'm going to do something novel tonight, in addition to the advertisement at the beginning, and go to biology. Who would have thunk it? They discovered a new organ. I don't know if any of you people are aware, but you now are the proud owner of eight different organs in your body. The 79th one, which is not the one I'm going to really discuss that much, is the mesentery. That was the previously discovered organ, and that's the a bit of cellular tissue that stitches your intestines all together in one folded mess. This new thing is called the interstitium. It's a very, very loose collection of branching connective tissue filled with fluid. And it's said to contain at least one-fifth of your body's entire amount of fluid, mostly lymphatic fluid. No one really knew that it existed. It was only detected because of all the endoscopic examinations of different bits and pieces of people where they were noticing this kind of spongy, fluid-filled material. Because if you wait until people pass away or if you cut them open, it tends to leak out, and it's not as obvious as it is with an endoscope. So congratulations to us all. We have an 80th organ called the interstitium. Enjoy it.
Talk to you, man. Most people are quite familiar with the vascular system of arteries and veins and blood flow. And most of us have a naive opinion that the blood flow is what's feeding all of our cells. It is my belief, Roy, that most of us have rather little information about the lymphatic system. Therefore, maybe this would be a good time. You, as a practicing physician, can tell us a little bit more about the lymphatic system and lymph nodes. I suspect, I'm guessing, that the vascular system feeds nourishment to the lymph system, and it's the lymph system that really feeds the individual cells. That's a guess on my part. I bet you there's a lot more to it. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
The lymphatic system, and who knows what they'll discover next Wednesday, is primarily a immunological especially because of all the lymph nodes that are full of white blood cells and manufacture, different materials to fight off infection. And so nutrients per se are mostly delivered in the plasma of blood. Erythrocytes, so the red blood cells, carry your oxygen. They get rid of your carbon dioxide. The plasma will carry sugar and proteins and all kinds of fun stuff. It gets absorbed by cells through capillaries. Lymphatics are kind of slow and sluggish. They don't really work on pumps, except kind of secondary pressure from the circulatory system. And then gravity usually drains most of it back into the system. And it's primarily for antibodies and for white blood cells, and that's why when you get a cold or an infection, your lymph nodes swell up because the cell activity increases and the turnover increases. And so lymphatics, as we understand it at this point, is more for the ability to fight off infections as opposed to nutritional aspects.
Does the lymphatic fluid flow? I think it does. What's the beginning of the flow? What's the end of the flow? And does it have to flow through the lymph nodes? The lymph nodes seem to be where the immune system is heavily involved, but I think you're saying the lymphatic fluid only flows due to gravity. Okay. If it's flowing gravity, that implies it's flowing downward when you're standing upright. Where is it starting from? Where is it going to? And who's manufacturing that lymph fluid that's flowing? As you can tell, I don't know very much about lymph, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
No problem at all. It's a complicated and difficult, really, to evaluate, again, because it's such a diffuse organ. I mean, it takes up the entire body. It's fed through the circulatory system primarily. Your blood goes into your heart, pumps into your blood, into your lungs, oxygenates it, and supports the arteries and goes to capillaries where plasma and all kinds of fun proteins and such leak out through the capillaries. And the red blood cells just exchange gases, and those liquids kind of puddle, and then there are branches of valves, tubules that go one way, and so the muscle contractions in your body help progress the lymphatics to bigger and bigger chains, which are hooked in with your lymph nodes, and get a kind of a squirt of the fluid before it eventually gets reabsorbed into the vascular chain. So it's a kind of an out branch of the vascular chain. And when the valves break down, it's kind of self-evident. If you've ever seen people with what's called lymphedema, it's that their extremities can grow to be humongous because they no longer have any kind of system of valves getting the fluid back in the right direction. It puddles.
Are those lymphatic valves, how many, where are they located? Are they associated with the lymph nodes? And roughly how many lymph nodes are in a human body? Is it hundreds? Over to you, Roy.
You're going to burn me, you fucking bastard.
Gosh, I wish I knew the exact number. I think it's things like the rivers in the United States. There's a lot of them, but no one's quite sure how many of them there are. But there are probably hundreds of lymph nodes scattered throughout the average body.
Let's see if we have anybody with any further questions on this subject. And is this the last subject you have on your list tonight, Roy? First of all, we'll wait to see if anyone has any further questions. If not, Roy, you pick it up and tell us, is this your last topic or do you have another one? K2LIW listening.
KD2PKA, question.
Mr. PKA, please start off with your name and then your question.
My name is Jay. I was just curious about the lymphedema. Is there any doctors that specialize in that right now?
Yeah, there's whole organizations that specialize it. There's something in Woodbury called the Lymphedema Center. That's one of many centers where day in and day out, they give aid to people with lymphedema conditions. Over to you, Jay.
I know somebody that went to the lymphedema clinic in St. Charles Hospital in Port Jeff, and they were saying that was like one of the only ones on Long Island. So it's good to know they have another one there.
Yeah, there's at least one more that I know of, and that particular one, and I think it's Woodbury, Hicksville, Woodbury area. It's on Palmer to something Road. I can't think of the name of the Don Road right now. If you want, I'll try to get the address for you. But they've been in business for quite a number of years. They seem to be quite successful. I have reason to believe they have a good number of patients that are reasonably happy with that service. So there are a few more of them, Jay, as I see it. Over to you, Jay.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I got the hospital wrong. It was actually Mather Hospital.
I bet you've heard of a few of those centers, Roy. So there's one in Nassau. What Jay just told us, there's one in Suffolk. And I'll bet you Brooklyn and Queens also has at least one. Over to you, Roy.
Unfortunately, I'm sure they do, and I'm certain Manhattan has a few. I was just looking up to see the latest guess on how many lymph nodes the average person has, and the way they describe it is somewhere between 500 and 700, so you sort of get an idea of how vague all this is, because it's not like a simple thing that you could just open some part of the body up and take a look. You basically have to look all over the body. And as someone who had a gross anatomy class, that's not a simple thing to do. But it's a pity. Lymphedema is a nasty thing. It depends upon the cause primarily, whether something can be significantly done or just palliative measures are they available. So it's usually the cause that's far more important than the condition.
Because a person with lymphedema typically gets swelling of that part of the body, I think one of the major methods of controlling it is by using support garments. If, for instance, you have a foot swelling, a lower leg swelling, they will give you a support hose to control the amount of swelling. And from what I hear, that does a pretty good job. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of primarily the method. Other than finding the underlying condition that's provoking it, the best that we have is elastic stockings and such to put some pressure on it. You don't want to put too much pressure, because if you put too much pressure, you might disrupt the vascular flow, and that'll cause other problems. So you got to get that point in the pressure where you haven't cut off blood flow.
KD2PKA.
Go right ahead, Jay.
Yes, they have what's called a ready wrap. It's made with Velcro, and you can tighten it to whatever you need for that problem for your whole body. They have different wraps that fit.
I believe they use those wraps as a first step in the process, where step by step they bring the swelling down to a reasonable number. Then I think what a lymphedema center does is to fit you for a compression garment that you use from then on and replace it periodically. So the ready wrap is just to bring down the excess swelling in the beginning, and I don't think they use that continuously. The compression garment is a lot easier to use. For a normal person to wrap his leg or arm with ready wrap every day, so to speak, would be a little bit more than you can ask for the average patient to do. That's a bunch of opinions on my part. Over to you, Eddie. Question Jay.
Yes, no, ready wrap is made by Solaris. And it is a garment that you use to put on. It's not like a wrapping. It's already put together there. It's a article of like that fits you.
So I think you're saying they take some careful measurements and have a garment specifically built for your size of that particular leg or arm. Is that what you're saying, Jay?
They do that, and also they have some that are made in different sizes. You can order it in different sizes, and it's already made that way. But they do measure you to see if it fits.
From your exposure, Roy, is lymphedema a relatively rare disease, or do you think 10% of the population sometimes runs into it? There, I don't know. Give me a guess if you happen to know. Over to you, Roy.
I wouldn't say it's a rare disorder because a lot of people at one point or another develop episodes of it, and it thankfully resolves. And a much smaller percentage, it's a chronic situation that cannot be improved upon. But, sometimes if it's infection or if it's fluid overload or toxic materials, there's all kinds of reversible ways of treating it and having it go away. So a lot of people will have it at one point of their lives, but most people, fortunately, it won't be a chronic disorder.
And one of the things we should mention is there's a very specific difference between lymphedema and lymphoma. Lymphedema is a swelling-like problem. Lymphoma, I think, is a kind of cancer. Is that true, Roy?
Lymphedema is again, Latin, Greek, water in your lymphatic system. Lymphoma is a cancer, so they're quite different.
Are you ready to go on to your next subject, or do you think we should stop for tonight? The choice is yours.
I don't know. I mean, I have some things, but it probably would take too long, so I probably best to leave them for next week. We could always use fresh material, and we'll go to the space report.
Okay, I thank you, Roy. Good stuff. As I pass it over now to the space report, just in case somebody's got a further question for Roy, you could give it to us, but most likely we're going to go over to Paul. The space report number 293, I think it is. Yes, 293. So, it looks like the Chinese space station did come down, and it came down during the TechNet, which is a little bit sooner than I thought it was going to take place. And James Webb has been further delayed, but that doesn't scare me. The fact that the James Webb was going to be launched later in 2018, and right now the best prediction is May of 2020. They discovered some other errors they want to correct. And because it's going to be going a million miles away from the Earth, to Lagrange point number 2, on the backside of the moon, so to speak, a million miles away, essentially no repair capability. They've got to get it right. And I think it's up to $8 or $9 billion of total cost at this time, spread over a whole lot of years. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a ball.
Okay, this is WS2N. And Tiangong 1, it deorbited, apparently. But they, anything below 100 kilometers or 62 miles considered deorbited. So whether it got that low or not, I'm not sure. Nobody's been able to say so far from what I'm reading of where it actually hit. I'm still seeing predictions of South Pacific. In other words, I saw it going over Argentina, and then it was predicted that it was breaking up before it got to Africa. And then after that, I haven't seen anything, except that you know, a couple of websites are predicting that it's going to continue going around until it got to the South Pacific. So I'm going to have to wait another couple more hours to find out for sure. Irrelevant, I'm sure it's shot. We don't have to worry about it hitting here. WS1, let me drop it. Okay, on Monday I listened and watched the Weimark participate in a school contact in Freeport. And because they gave out the live stream on the club net, on the FONet on Monday, I was able to write that down. And sure enough, it came up on exactly on time, around 1 o'clock on Monday. And nice picture, good audio. And I watched the whole presentation. Craig was there. I saw him talk, and he was telling the audience what the story was. Did a great job on that. I say Craig, Katie, to ZXK, our vice president, did a very good job at handling that. And I'm sure a couple of other Weimar people were involved, but I'm not sure yet who. I guess we'll find out as time goes on. And they contacted Scott Tingle, was the astronaut that was speaking to him. And I counted about 15 contacts. So, maybe seven or eight children got to ask questions. And it was great watching it on the computer from the drop it. And they did a telebridge contact. So that means they were transmitting to Italy, talking through the telephone system to Italy, and then Italy was using the telebridge system with their radio talking directly to the space station as it went overhead. And, interesting, they used a different call letter, ORR4ISS. Apparently in Europe that's what they use. When we did it here, my daughter's school, the telebridge was located in the United States. It was in Santa Rosa, California. We used NA1ISS. NA1SS. So that was pretty cool. Looking at the different call letters that they use. If they make Russian contacts, for the people in Russia, they use another call letter. But all in all, it's very good. Another winner for Weimark. I know they've done it before. They helped us out, too. Let me drop it this WS to us. I wonder if anybody is on frequency that saw that feed or has any further information about that contact in Freeport. I'd be interested in hearing it. WS to us. Okay, apparently not, but that's always great. And you wonder how long that's going to be there. We talk about the Iridium satellites eventually disappearing. Are we not going to have a space station, after, say, 2025 or 2028 or something? Could the Ares, system go the way of Starek? Starek system was the shuttle amateur radio experiment when they had the hams onboard shuttle without a space station talking directly to Earth. Of course, that's gone, and now we have amateur radio on the International Space Station, and maybe we'll have a gateway space station in the future going around the moon with a couple of astronauts on there with a call letter, and maybe we'll make lunar contact from lunar orbit. That would be something. Let me just go on to the next topic, which was the Iridium satellites, which we more or less talked about. SpaceX did launch them successfully, 10 of them into orbit. And they, like I said before earlier, they did not recover the booster on purpose. That was the plan. The present boosters they're using now, they just used twice, which is, you know, a first for any rockets to be going up to reuse going into orbit. Now that they've gotten good at it, there's something called the Block 5 version of the Falcon 9 coming out, and that should be flying in a couple of months. The first mission is they're going to be putting a satellite into geosynchronous orbit for Bangladesh, and they're going to launch from Launch Complex 39A in Florida. So I'll be looking forward to that. That's an upgraded rocket. And instead of being able to reuse it two times, they plan on reusing this thing 10 times. And then after 10 times, refurbish it back in their plant in Texas and put it out again and do another 10 flights. And he's got high hopes of using the same booster up to 100 times. So, you know, SpaceX has a lot of plans, a lot of flights on their manifest. Right now they're doing 20 last year, and they plan on doing like 30 and maybe 40 next year. With that, they're going to need as many boosters to safely be returned either directly to land, like they do in Florida, and soon to be done also in California. They plan on flying boosters back to California. And, of course, landing them on the drone ships, one in the east and one in the west. On this Iridium flight that they had, it was another test to see if they could save the $6 million fairing. Fairing is the two pieces that cover the spacecraft at the top of the rocket. Presently, in the past, they split open and they come back to Earth. They usually burn up or destroyed on the way down. And lately, he's been trying to save them. He got one to land without being destroyed into the water a couple of months ago. He would like to land it on a ship. He's got a ship out there called Mr. Stevens, and it's got these big arms, forearms welded to the ship sticking out. So it's this massive thing, probably about, you know, looks like about 200 feet by 200 foot net sitting above the boat. And his plan is to have this half a fairing for now come down and land in this net on a parachute system. He's using a paraglide type of parachute. On board the fairing, he has, you know, a GPS, and this paraglide is able to guide itself toward the recovery boat. And when it separates from the satellite, originally it has nitrogen jets. It's got a couple of tanks of nitrogen, and then a manifold that comes off with all these different pieces of tubing that go to all these different locations on the fairing. And he's able to, you know, in a vacuum, flying in space, to adjust it and have it enter the atmosphere just right where it doesn't burn up, and then it gets down to a certain altitude and he's able to eventually open up the parachute. Unfortunately, the test that he had for this Iridium flight, when it came back down on the paraglide, the parachute essentially got all twisted up, and it didn't work out, and the thing came down and crashed into the ocean and was destroyed. Originally, when I heard this, I said, well, why can't they just, you know, land it in the ocean and float over to it to pick it up, which actually they did the last time. They could do that. but the problem is the electronics on board and some of the materials on the bearing get destroyed with the salt water. So that's not an option. And that's why he's got this catch-a-met design on the ship at the Stevens. So eventually, if this works out, he'll have two ships on the West Coast for the flights that leave California to catch the two half pieces that are coming down. And he's going to have two identical ships on the East Coast for the flights that take off from Florida. And his reasoning is to save these $6 million pieces and reuse them. So, again, another way of cutting costs on space flight. So, another important flight is coming up tomorrow, April 2nd. And it will be in the afternoon. So if you're off and you have a computer nearby, 4:30 in the afternoon, you go to the NASA channel. And you'll be able to see a space launch by SpaceX launching cargo vehicle going up to the International Space Station. This will be their 14th paid cargo trip up to the space station. Actually, the 16th, correction. They called it. It's the 14th operational one, but the 16th time that they've done this type of thing. First couple were like, they really weren't getting paid for it. It was a test, but they call it the operational flight number 14. But really 16 different times over the years. I think dating back to 2012, they started WS-1. So they'll be bringing cargo up and food and everything, oxygen supply, all kinds of science equipment, and roughly about, I think it's around 5,500 pounds worth of cargo. They have cargo in a pressurized section. When they open the door, you go inside, take in all the stuff out, bring it into the space station. And then there's always science equipment in what they call the trunk of the Dragon spacecraft. SpaceX has this Dragon that, it's got this big open area in the back, and they call that the trunk. And after it's first connected to the International Space Station, later on, days or weeks from now, they come across and grab it with the Canadian robot arm, a 57-foot arm that is attached permanently to the International Space Station. They'll be able to take out the science material and then install it to the exterior part of the space station. And they'll probably stay attached for a month or two, usually, and then detach with other science equipment. And also, sometimes they want to get rid of something. And it might be a large, old battery packs or something. They'll attach that to the trunk of the SpaceX Dragon. And what they'll do is, before they re-enter, that trunk will disconnect, burn up in the atmosphere. But whatever's inside the cargo hold will be safely returned. They come down with the heat shield, parachute opens up, and they land a couple hundred miles off the coast of California. And SpaceX has their own ship out there. They'll pick it up and bring it back, and they'll be able to return all this science equipment, sometimes even space suits that have to be returned. So it's the only vehicle that does that right now. The rest of the cargo vehicles that go up, another one's going up a couple months from now from Wallops Island. Orbital ATK is going to do another launch with their Antares rocket, and they'll do the same thing. They'll go up and bring up 6,000 to 7,000 pounds of equipment attached to the space station. And when they come back, they just burn up over the Pacific Ocean the way they're supposed to. the way the Chinese were supposed to burn up the Tiangong 1 space station. You know, the idea is to always have enough fuel and control of your platform and have it properly deorbit over the Pacific, where there's nobody out there that's going to be hurt. They're not supposed to lose control and have this thing land willy-nilly anywhere in the world. Let me drop it. On this net, it must have been a couple of months ago. I think it was Roy, ACTGS, that brought up the story about Mike Hughes. Mike Hughes is this guy that lives in California. And he built his own rocket ship. And it happens to be steam-powered. And he wanted to launch himself in this thing. And he came close a couple of times. The idea, he's got this idea that the world is flat, you know. I mean, he looks at the moon, the sun, and he says, that's not a ball, that's flat. And you say flat, like a big rectangle? No, flat like a frisbee, you know, like a dish. So he's one of those kind of guys. And he says, well, I'm going to launch myself high enough to do this. So he did this about a little over a week ago now. He launched himself, went through Mojave Desert, climbed into this thing, and took off. And he got as high as, I wrote it down here somewhere, here it is, 1,875 feet. So he got up there pretty high. And he came back, parachute opened up. He landed pretty hard, they said. He's not a kid, he's 61 years old. So they took him to the hospital just for, to check himself out. He thinks he's okay. He knows he had a rough time. You know, this thing goes off with tremendous force. So who knows how many G's he reached. I guess that date will come out sooner or later. Even coming back down, you know, what kind of a landing did he have? So since we talked about this guy on the net, I thought I'd bring that up. I found a picture of him. I found a picture of his rocket. And I also found a picture of him being put into the ambulance after his successful flight, really. I mean, he made it back alive. Ultimate goal of doing it again, he wants to eventually shoot himself into suborbital space. I mean, he's got to get above the common line, which is like 52 miles up. We'll see if he ever makes that. On the International Space Station, talking about that, we now have 6 people on the space station going overhead, and the 3 that were up there were now joined by Drew Kustel and Ricky Arnold and Oleg Artemyev, the Russian from Roscosmos. Roscosmos is Russian version of NASA. And one of these two guys, yeah, I saw interviews with Drew and with Ricky, the two Americans. One of these guys were talking about, they talk about their personal lives, you know, what they've done. And one of the things he came out with is he's afraid of heights. You know, he's not crazy about going up on ladders or anything. So we were talking about that earlier tonight. But he can go up, you know, he manages to get over his fear. He can go up to the space station. He's been up before. And in fact, they do EVAs, go outside the space station. And this guy has fear of heights. One other thing I was going to talk about, but Dick, you already brought it up, was the James Webb Space Telescope now being delayed. They've run into some problems. One of the problems is, you know, they have to open up this big sun shield, and it's got 5 layers of mylar insulation, very, very thin. You know, and apparently they've developed a couple of rifts in it, and opening and closing it. And to open it and close it, doesn't take 5 minutes. It takes like a month or so. Well, they thought it was going to take a month. It took like 2 months. just one delay after the other. They're having some problems also with the antenna, trying to work on that. That's something wrong with that system. The Borrelia blast, trying to fold it properly into, you know, so it gets into the right configuration to be put on board an Ariane 5 rocket. They're working on some factors that are involved with that. Make a long story short, this was originally supposed to go up like 2017, end of 2017, then 2018, and now they're pushing it back to 2020. They said June of 2019, but one article said they'll be ready to launch by 2020. So, you gotta hope they get it right. They're gonna be sitting 1 million miles away from Earth, no chance to go out and repair it in case there's a problem. It's not like the Hubble. The Hubble, I think, is like 500 miles up. It was in range of the space shuttle to go service it. Space shuttle had the highest altitude the shuttle would be able to go was around 600, 650. And the Hubble was at around 500. So, that's the story with that. Covered the Chinese space station Tangong 1. And last week I made an announcement to see if anybody would watch the news conference for TESS. TESS is the space telescope that'll be going up in April. We're in April now. That would be 15 days from now, April 16th. Going down to a low power, and as the radio heats up, that launch will be going up April 16th and 6:32 at night, and this one will be launched also from Florida by SpaceX, and this is an interesting one. This is the one that's going to be going out toward the moon to an orbit that's never been used before. It will be orbiting the Earth, but an extreme elliptical path, like 6,000 miles high above our Earth here, will be the low point, but the high point will be 250,000 miles out where the moon crosses. Now, it will definitely be on a different inclination. They said around 40, a little over 40 degree inclination. So, it won't be in the ecliptic plane. And they're doing that for a couple of reasons. One reason is if they were, they would come across too many transits of, basically eclipses with the moon and the sun. They're avoiding that with this type of orbit. Also, this orbit is very stable. Once they get into this high elliptical orbit, going near the Earth and then all the way out to where the moon is, and doing that every 14 days, that orbit, they will not need any fuel whatsoever, and they'll be able to stay like that for years, many, many years, without using any fuel. And the reason for that is when they get out to the moon orbit, the moon won't be there. The moon will be like 90 degrees in front of it. So that moon still has a tug on the spacecraft. It'll tug it a little faster. It'll pull it along. But then the next time the spacecraft does a complete orbit near the Earth and it goes all the way back out and goes back out to the orbit of the moon, it'll be 14 days later. Actually, 13.7, but 14 days later. That moon will come around another 180 degrees. But that'll put it 90 degrees, not in front of the spacecraft, it'll put it 90 degrees behind the spacecraft. So it will be pulling on it a little bit, and it will actually be tugging on and trying to slow down the spacecraft a touch. So this happens over and over again, month after month, year after year. You're never going to need any kind of fuel to, you know, to worry about where the spacecraft is going to change its position. So that's why one of the things I found out about watching that news conference. Also, they talked about the cameras. There's four cameras on board. And for the first year, they're going to be studying, looking for exoplanets south of the equator, you know, the southern hemisphere. They'll be looking out in that direction and covering the whole, like the whole sky, like 94% of the sky. Northern hemisphere, and each camera covers like 90 degrees wide by 24 degrees, you know, up and down, so they'll be able to, you know, over that 1 year, cover like the whole northern part of the sky on the second year, and they'll be looking out for planets relatively close by, around 200 light years away or so, not thousands of light years like Kepler was doing. So that was pretty good. There's a couple of more things here, but I'll turn it back to the net and see if anybody has any questions, and we'll see if anybody has any comments or questions for the space portion of the TechNet. K2RIWS2S. W-H-4-Y-Y, any questions for this section?
Joe, recognized. Before I turn it over to Joe, Paul, the TESS orbit that's heavily involved with the moon, is that at all like a Lagrange point number 4 and 5, which is the triangular pattern between Earth and moon? Or is it a brand new, I'm pretty sure you did say it's a brand new orbit.
Repeater, time out.
I'm pretty sure you said it's a brand new orbit, so I guess it's not like a Lagrange 4 or 5. Does it have a name? And not easy to understand. I guess we'd have to see the diagram. Over to you on that one, Paul.
Yeah, it's called P. I think they call it P2, but it's really P divided by 2, I think. So that means the period of the moon divided by 2. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio. So in other words, moon takes, let's call it 30 days. You know, I don't have the exact number here, but let's call it 30 days just to understand this thing. And let's say that the spacecraft is going to go out to that lunar orbit every, let's call it 15 days. It's really 13.7. We'll call it 15 days, a half a month. So 1 month for the moon to go completely around the Earth. If you have the spacecraft that's going to go out to that orbit and, you know, to get there all, and all the way back again is 15 days, that means it's going to take 7.5 days, you know, to get to that orbit. Another 7.5 days to get back to Earth. Okay, so that's 15 days. Say the moon is 90 degrees in front of TESS when TESS is at that lunar distance. You know, so that's, you know, it's way in front of TESS. Now, you got to understand that TESS is not following the ecliptic orbit of the planets or the moon for that matter. You know, forget about the moon being 6 degrees, you know, off plane from the ecliptic. You know, make believe it's all on the ecliptic. And again,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let's say it's going over the North Pole of Earth and over the South Pole of Earth. Okay, so that means. That means, let's see, if the moon is way ahead of, by the time the spacecraft gets to 250,000 miles. That will be pulling on the moon. Once they pull it forward. And then another 14 days later, we drop